You're listening to a special UK election edition of Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a special election edition of Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Britain is going to the polls in the closest general election in more than a generation.
The fact of this election is that Labour is facing wipeout in Scotland.
And seeing it through demands new and different leadership. But today I want to tell you how we can make it happen. Today I want to tell you why Britain needs a Labour government.
What we would do is seek to exercise the influence that Scotland had given us in the House of Commons to win progressive change on policies like an end to austerity and protection for public services.
This would be the first time in our history that a group of nationalists from one part of our country would be involved in altering the direction of the government of our country.
With just 4 hours to go until the polls close, debate has already turned to what happens after the vote. If there's no clear winner, who will become Prime Minister? I'll discuss that and more with my studio guests Sebastian Borger and John Rentall. That's all to come on this special UK election edition of Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and John Rentall, chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday and visiting professor at King's College London. John and Sebastian, welcome to you both.
Good afternoon.
We will, at some stage, ask you what you think is going to happen with 4 hours until the polls close, slightly put you on the spot.
Peculiar form of cruelty, that
is. I know. But John, perhaps if we can begin just by looking back at what sort of election this has been, because I think going into this election, you know, we've had the financial crash a few years ago, we had the MPs expenses scandal a few years ago, we've had the scenario of Nick Clegg, the only politician who was relatively well liked before he went into coalition, breaking a promise, a massive promise on tuition fees. British politics was in a bad place, but I'd argue we're in a slightly better place after this election.
Yes, I don't agree with the common theme that you read in a lot of commentary, which is that the election has been negative and boring. I think it's been absolutely fascinating and relatively positive compared with previous elections. Actually, I think there has been an awful lot of policy that's been discussed, and I think there's been a wider range of voices heard from. I mean, partly because of the minor parties gaining much more prominence in the TV debates and the TV programmes. So I think it's actually been quite an edifying election. I mean, obviously there've been negative themes running through it too, but I mean, that's an election. Election is a choice.
Sebastian, do you think it's been an edifying election? Do you think that it's been an election that, you know, people have really got involved in?
I think people got involved. Edifying, I don't think I would use. There we are. It's. I was struck by the way by the timidness of a lot of politicians vis-a-vis the public, particularly last week, the last of the TV debates, which was done by the BBC, and they interviewed. People in a studio interviewed or asked questions to the three main party leaders. And I thought the way they went about it was really rather unpleasant, rude, totally, lots of them totally ignorant.
The public, totally ignorant.
Yeah, yeah. And none of these guys actually pointed it out and said, look, please get your facts right before you challenge me like that. I understand that it's awkward to challenge your bosses.
The voters are always right.
But someone quite rightly said, no boss would treat a job applicant the way these politicians were treated.
Mm. John, do you think that that's just a reflection of, you know, some of the residual anger there is amongst the public towards some of the politicians? Or is that, you know, a healthy example of what democracy is like?
I think it's a healthy example of democracy. I mean, and it's not new. I mean, I remember being much more shocked in 2005 by the rudeness and the aggressiveness of the studio audience in the same programme, actually, the BBC Question Time format. They were very aggressive towards Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister. I thought
about
that
the Iraq War. That was one clear question, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't just the Iraq War, to
the opposition leader Michael Howard. Back
No, but it was primarily the Iraq War. But they were also very, very rude about the state of the NHS and whether you could get to see your GP. Questions like that. I feel divided about that because you shouldn't be too deferential towards your politicians. You should be tough with them, but you shouldn't be rude.
But it's also, Sebastian, you mentioned that Question Time event. That was the first real time, and really the only time, that we saw members of the public able to question or have a go at leaders of their parties. This has been a very stage managed campaign, hasn't it?
That is the complaint. Although, again, I've seen the last four election campaigns here. They all seem to me fairly staged. If a protester gets to the deputy prime minister, throws an egg, and the deputy prime minister throws a punch at him, that was the fun thing. The other thing was last time Gordon Brown, the prime minister, talking to a citizen in Rochdale and calling her a bigoted woman, but only because the microphone was where it shouldn't have been. So, you know.
Yes.
Stage management, I think, has been around for at least 15, 20 years.
And much longer, much longer.
But it's also, John, it's been, whether we can argue it's been stage managed or not, obviously parties want to sort of, put forward their platform as carefully as possible. To go back to something Sebastian mentioned before about the timidity, both main parties have tried to play it quite safe, haven't they? Ed Miliband, because he wants to show, look, I'm prime ministerial,
yes,
I won't be too extreme, look I at will. Me, I'll be always in my suit,
and
I'm
always here behind
a lectern. Always behind a lectern, look at me.
Yes.
Whereas David Cameron, certainly initially, seem to be playing it very safe as well, trying to rely on the economy and competence versus chaos.
Well, and refusing to take part in full-scale TV debates, as happened in the last election. So he definitely played a safe defensive campaign, and we're about to find out whether it was a good tactic or not. I mean, I suspect he needed to take some risks because it's the Conservatives who actually are coming from behind and need to gain some extra voters.
If you had to pick one high and one low, Sebastian, from the campaign so far?
I thought the low was the way the public in Leeds treated your politicians. Because, no, we don't want to be deferential, but we want to, give these guys some credit for doing a tough job under very difficult circumstances. Guys and ladies, obviously.
A high?
Is there a high? I don't think there was a high.
Is there not? There isn't a high?
No high at all.
You're in a sour mood today.
A high is, for me, when I traipse around candidates in constituencies, in marginals, where active engagement happens. I mean, that's great for a German to see, because it doesn't happen like that at all in Germany. That you as a candidate, you go to people's houses, knock on the door, and say, "I'm Peter Miller. Can I count on your support on Thursday?" I think that's still great.
Mm.
Do you want a high and a low?
Well, my high and my low are both the same thing. Actually, it was the Labour tombstone when Ed Miliband decided to make his promises so believable that he would carve them in
stone.
I mean, I just thought that must be a joke when I first heard about it, because it was reported quite low down in the running order by the Observer newspaper, I think, on one of the sort of final weekends, and yet, there he was doing an actual photo opportunity with this slab of limestone. I mean, that was the most pathetic and absurd gimmick I've ever seen in British politics. And yet it was also the high point because it was so funny.
If he lost, I think he lost because of stuff like that.
Yeah.
He's trying for months. He's trying to tell us that I'm prime ministerial. I can eat a bacon sandwich and all that. And then he does something like this.
What I want to ask you both now, because tomorrow, or probably not tomorrow, because we may not even know then who's won tomorrow. But at some stage, everyone will be writing pieces like, this is why Ed Miliband lost, or this is why David Cameron lost and won. Yeah. John, if you had to write, you know, an article tomorrow explaining why Ed Miliband lost, what would it be saying?
Well, that's a very hard one. I mean, in a sense, I've already written that beforehand, just in case, just in case he loses. Which, you know, on balance, I don't think he's going to do. I think he will end up being prime minister. But if he loses, it'll be because the Labour Party made the wrong choice of leader back in 2010, and I think everything flows from that. I think. I was in a way proved wrong, because I didn't expect Ed Miliband to come this close and to run such a close election campaign. I mean, he ought to be prime minister after this election, and so if he isn't, then, you know, I won't say I told you so, but I think the Labour Party did make the wrong choice 5 years ago.
And just to stick on that, what do you think he's done right then to get to this stage? Is it the fact that the Tories have run a weak, too timid campaign, or is it actually that, you know, he's done all right and people looked at him and gone, oh, he's not as weird as I thought?
Well, I don't think he's done much right, to be honest. I mean, I think the Conservatives have handed it to him. I think all the important things that the Conservatives have done wrong have lost the election for them. I mean, primarily allowing themselves to be portrayed as a party of the rich.
So this is going back 3 years when they cut
the top rate of income tax. And at the start of the election campaign, when Labour launched this this promise to abolish this non-dom tax status, which is just a tax.
This idea,
tax
so 100,000 very rich people,
yeah,
some of whom used to live abroad, who don't pay any tax here.
Yeah, it is completely indefensible, and Labour promised to abolish it, and the Conservatives failed to match that promise straight away. George Osborne, the Chancellor, should have come out straight away and said, it's too late, I've already abolished it.
Well, he should have done it 2 years ago.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, this is the thing, Sebastian, isn't it? When you look at the Tory campaign, you think, it wouldn't have been that hard to have run a winning campaign. For a start, they could have come out with the tax on non-doms,
yes,
before this campaign, and put Labour in a position of going, well, I don't know whether we can support this or not. They could have pushed for a higher minimum wage, which again would have put pressure on Labour. Were you to be writing an article tomorrow saying this is why David Cameron lost, what would be the reasons?
I think they've run a pretty awful campaign. He tells me before the 6 week campaign starts, he tells me that he doesn't want a third term. he isn't even near winning the second term. Awful, I thought. First,
and why is that second, awful? Is that awful because it shows that he's...
Complacency. You know, I will have a second term, but I won't take the third term, which will be on offer. Who knows, you know? Terrible. I thought terrible. Secondly, the non-dom story. I mean, they shouldn't have given Labour that opening at all.
Yeah.
Thirdly, you know, if you tell me for the last year that we are the party of competence, of economic recovery, and which is great, which is true, you know, British growth is the best in the G7.
Well, yeah, but growth from what and from
growth
when?
Growth from what? Exactly. Let's debate that. But, you know, that's the headline figure. The unemployment rate is lower than in Germany. Let's not forget that. You know, Germany, which is the powerhouse of the Eurozone still. But then to suddenly make a U-turn and throw around promises without telling me how they're going to be financed, well, that all my supporters will say, well, how am I now on the doorstep telling people we are the party of competence? It looks incompetent.
And there was this issue, John, wasn't there, that not that actually, you know, many broadcast journalists managed to pin them down on exactly how they're going to pay for all this. But there was this issue that if they're going to say times are really tough, and therefore we need £12 billion of welfare cuts more,
yes,
we won't say what they are, by the way, but
yes,
we need all this more. You can't then also turn around and say, but here's £8 billion for the NHS.
Yes, they got into a terrible tangle with that. I mean, they made the calculation that because they had established an advantage over Labour on reputation for economic competence, they could do economically incompetent things and promise economically unbelievable things and people would believe them. And, you know, people are just not that stupid. It didn't do them any good. But I mean, I shouldn't say that, you know, if the Conservatives lose, it's all their fault. I mean, I do have to give Ed Miliband some credit for holding his party together and for running a more sinuous campaign over the 5 years than I thought he was capable of. I mean, he has actually quite cleverly sort of brought his own left wing along while presenting a rather moderate and pragmatic and, dare I say, new Labourish face to the electorate. And that's quite a clever trick to pull off. And he's done better at pulling that off than I thought he would.
Never underestimate the discipline of the Labour Party. That's the lesson I take away from this. Because
that is quite new.
You've heard. No, sorry.
No.
They had such an incompetent Prime Minister, the last Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. They didn't topple him.
Yes.
Then they got Ed Miliband elected, and against the majority of MPs and party members.
Yes.
And they still stuck it out with him.
Yes.
Extraordinary.
Let's talk about some of the smaller parties, and let's start with what's happening in Scotland, which is one of those that political pundits and commentators look at it and go, well, look, I know the polls are saying that the SNP are going to sweep all before them, but it just can't be right. It just can't be right. It probably is right, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the extraordinary thing about this election campaign is how little has happened, actually, both during the campaign and during the 5 years beforehand. I mean, I think the main points of the campaign were decided some time ago, except for Scotland. I mean, Scotland has been the most extraordinary turnaround and the most unexpected turnaround, and that's happened just in the last 6 months since the referendum in September.
And to put this into context, the SNP currently have 6 out of 59 seats Scotland. By tomorrow morning, they could have 50.
At least, yes. I mean, they could have more than 50. I mean, it is almost inexplicable for us London-based Westminster bubble inhabiting journalists to understand. I mean, it is as if the entire Scottish nation has taken its head off and run round in little circles. They have become completely enthused by this weird form of triumphalism in defeat. I mean, the nationalists lost the referendum, and yet the whole of Scottish politics has been revolutionised and turned on its head.
And on that point, John, you know, what you're saying may well be true, but the fact that those opposing Scottish nationalists have used pretty much your argument there doesn't really help in Scotland, does it?
What, insulting people in Scotland who support the SNP by accusing them of being
mad? But I mean, that has been a big part of the sort of, not the official campaign against the SNP, but a bit like, guys, what are you talking about? This makes sense.
Yeah, well, none of it does make sense on a rational level, obviously. But I mean, clearly what's happening here is an emotional thing that's to do with Scottish identity. And in a way, losing the referendum has given the SNP permission to be much more nationalistic than winning it ever would have done. It's a bizarre paradox.
Sebastian, much has been made about the so-called legitimacy of the SNP MPs and what role they can play in a UK-wide government. Now, many Scottish people will be thinking, well, hang on, last year you guys all wanted us to be part of the UK. Now you're saying we don't want you to be part of the UK government.
Well, first of all, let's be clear that we're talking about 45% of Scottish voters here. We're not talking about a majority of the Scottish people having lost their head. The SNP have managed very well to keep the 45% that voted for independence and basically get them to now apparently vote for the SNP in these elections. They managed that because of a grave mistake by David Cameron on the morning after the referendum, where he somehow linked Scottish devolution with this very weird concept of English votes for English laws, when all the constitutional experts I speak to say to me that there are no English laws because it all affects all parts of the United Kingdom, but that's by the way. Every MP has the same legitimacy as his or her neighbour, I would have thought. Apart from, of course, well, no, none. Full stop. Now, you can talk about, the Scots still have too many seats compared to the population in Scotland. That is true, because the reform that the Tories were hoping for of the redrawing of the boundaries didn't happen. But that's too bad.
John, there is this issue that's been talked about that's, you know, it's not quite as bad as, you know, in Israel when Netanyahu tried to say the Arabs are coming to the polls in droves and dividing his nation like that. But there is something slightly uncomfortable about the way that some people in the Tory party and the Tory press are talking about the Scottish MPs as if they shouldn't have a right to have a voice.
I'm not sure about that, actually, Steve. I mean, I think the problem with the SNP is the same problem that afflicted the British state in 1910, when a balance of power in the House of Commons was held by Irish nationalists who wanted home rule for Ireland. And because they wanted something which affected the whole sort of setup of the nation, and they held the balance of power in the House of Commons, it led to constitutional deadlock because you know, they were able to obstruct the business of government, and the SNP will be able to do a similar sort of thing because they want, you know, ultimately they want to break up the United Kingdom. They don't actually want to be in the House of Commons. I mean, that's the paradox behind this position. That's why people talk about legitimacy, because, you know, these people, in a sense, don't want to be there. I mean, and Sinn Féin take that argument to its logical extreme and refuse to take their seats.
But if we've said to them, we want you to be part of the United Kingdom, stay with us, and then they say, fine, these are the people we want, yes, to send down to Westminster, who are we to turn around and say, oh, no, not those people?
Well, we're not, obviously. You have to respect the democratic wishes of the Scottish people. But you also have to be aware that the ultimate aim of the SNP is independence, and what they are after, what they will use their power in the House of Commons to do is to advance that cause, and they will, you know, they will press for anything which will give them an advantage and which will lead to a second referendum, which will produce what is for them the right result.
Well, I totally disagree. we have here, they have had the referendum. That's the great difference to 1910, when nobody would have even dreamt of giving the Irish a referendum.
That's true.
They've had a referendum. They've lost it.
Yes.
Let's just we here in London, be a little bit more optimistic about the state of the United Kingdom. The majority of Scots rejected independence. The SNP isn't stupid enough to put it in their next manifesto, I would bet, because they know they would lose again, and then it would be off the agenda for 20 years. Let's see what they've got to offer, and let's challenge them on their politics up in Scotland, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Totally fiscally incontinent, always relying on handouts from London, and then turning around and saying, you give them much more powers to raise their own taxes, and then we shall see how well the S&P fares.
Let's turn our attention to what might happen tomorrow morning. We're used to elections in this country. Everyone stays up. Well, not everyone stays up all night. Many of us stay up all night. And about 3 or 4 in the morning, it becomes abundantly clear who's won and who's lost. Last time, that didn't happen, and it took 5 days before there was a coalition put together. But even then, within the first day or so, it was quite clear what would possibly happen.
Yes.
John, tomorrow morning, we could be in a situation where David Cameron has more seats, but Ed Miliband has more support, let's put it that way, in the House of Commons. There's been all this talk about legitimacy in recent weeks, with some people in the Tory press saying, oh no, it wouldn't be legitimate for the party to come second to form a government. How important do you think those concerns are?
I don't. I think they essentially have been whipped up to give the press something to talk about in the last days of the campaign. Because the thing about election campaigns is that the journalists get bored with actually reporting policy. And in the last week or so,
really, you don't want a detailed discussion about pension reform.
<That's> right. So the last week of every election campaign is just given over to endless speculation about what might happen in different combinations of outcomes. But actually, I mean, you know, what happens tomorrow morning might be quite complicated, but the essence of it will still be very simple. I mean, the choice is, you know, we will either keep David Cameron as Prime Minister or we will switch to Ed Miliband as Prime Minister. And I think, you know, at some point in the early hours of tomorrow morning, it will become clear which of those is more likely. I mean, there will then have to be details to be thrashed out, no doubt. But I think, you know, that's a binary choice and it'll become clear.
I'll come back to you on that in just a moment. But Sebastian, you know, when we look across Europe, this happens all the time. That, you know, because there are more than two parties, there tend to be more proportional systems, and the party that comes second, whether that's in Sweden or Denmark or indeed, you know, a while ago now, but even in Germany, that's happened. Is this just because, you know, you have more sophisticated voters who understand that that winning isn't necessarily winning, or do you think this is something that we'll just get used to?
I have faith in the British electorate. I think they know their system. You know, I thought, for example,
I'm not sure about that.
For example, in 2005, Tony Blair got his third majority. Vastly reduced. A lot of Lib Dems got into parliament on the strength of the anti-Iraq sentiment, but the British people still, and it was a reduced percentage for Labour, but it was still clear we still want him to continue. We don't want the other lot. Last time Labour lost, that was clear. There was no clear winner. But Labour had lost. So there was no alternative to the coalition last time. This time, I think we shall see the Conservatives with more seats and quite a few more votes. And so David Cameron stays in Downing Street and then it goes through the normal parliamentary procedures. Not a problem.
But those normal parliamentary procedures are going to take a little bit longer this time, John, aren't they? Because Parliament doesn't come back until the 27th of May. So
well, they may do.
There's almost 3 weeks.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the civil service have been quite good at managing expectations this time around, because I think there was a feeling last time that the process was a little bit rushed. Although, as Sebastian says, I mean, you know, there was really only one likely outcome last time. I mean, a Labour rainbow coalition would have been very, very difficult to have put together, especially as it wasn't supported in the Labour Party. And this time, you know, maybe more evenly balanced. But I think the senior civil service have tried to prepare public opinion and press opinion for the fact that it might take a bit longer to work out the negotiations. And I think that you know, there won't be quite the same sort of hue and cry pressure on the politicians to come to an agreement.
But do you think that, you know, Sebastian, you'll have a situation where if David Cameron has more seats, he won't resign. Why should he? If he looks at all the numbers and realizes that he doesn't have the votes.
He should, well, obviously, if he hasn't got, if he isn't anywhere near the right number, then he will have to resign. But on the other hand, Ed Miliband made, in my view, that rather vast mistake of saying, I won't talk to the SNP, which is really silly, you know.
Well, it was clear on this, he went slightly too far on this, didn't he?
He could have very clearly
said, I'll do no formal deals, but I will talk to the Tories on defence issues and I will talk to the SNP on getting rid of the hated bedroom tax. So he could have spun a line like that.
He decided to go for a rather simple message, which is, you know, I hate the SNP and all its works.
I mean, know why he did it, of course,
yes.
Of course, because I've been to marginals in the famous Middle England, you know, East Midlands suburbia, and you, on every other doorstep, that's one of the things that comes up.
But that's not going to help
him. Ed Miliband doesn't look prime ministerial or...
That might help now, but it won't help him tomorrow.
I don't think that's a huge problem. I mean, there won't be a deal between Labour and the SNP. There will be, obviously, the sort of negotiations that go on around the back stairs of the House of Commons, vote by vote, in order to, you know, sound out what the SNP is going to do on a particular vote. But there won't be a deal, and I don't think anybody's going to say, oh, but hang on a minute, Ed Miliband, you promised you wouldn't even talk to the SNP.
Okay, we've got 15 seconds left. In a month's time, Sebastian, who will be Prime Minister?
David Cameron.
John Rentoul?
I think it'll be Ed Miliband.
Okay, I'm veering towards John, but we'll see. John Rentoul and Sebastian Borger, thank you both very much for joining us today. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Caroline Hammergren. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. I will be back tomorrow with another election special of Midori House. My guests then will be Isabel Hilton and George Brock. 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours if you're listening in New York. Up next, music, then Andrew Tuck at 1900 hours with The Urbanist. That's it for Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.